This is the MagicWordPodcast.com.
Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com. This week's episode is brought to you by Amazon. That's right. The Magic Word Podcast is an Amazon affiliate, so if you click on the button that is on the bottom of every web page on the MagicWordPodcast.com, just click on that. It will take you to your Amazon account, and whatever you purchase will help benefit us by giving a few pennies back. And as we get into the holiday season and the gift-giving season, now is a time when you probably use Amazon more regularly than usual. But this is something you could use, of course, throughout the year. But some of you have been using in the past, but this is just a gentle reminder to continue to do that, and particularly for your larger purchases. We might get even as much as a nickel back. Anyhow, thank you very much for that. And if you, again, go to themagicwordpodcast.com, scroll to the bottom of the page, and you will see a banner ad that will say we are an Amazon affiliate. Click on that, and it'll take you from there, and you'll figure out what to do. This week's episode is something that is kind of a reprise from the standpoint that a year ago, in episode number 809, we put together a show called Tales from the Road. And this was actually recorded at a session from the Magic at the Beach convention in Myrtle Beach last year. And Charles Bach allowed us again this year to record this and to broadcast this on the podcast. I like to provide you with interesting stories. And whenever I talk with guests, I try to pull out these kinds of interesting stories to make this podcast not only interesting to you, but also educational, so that you get something out of it and learn from that as well. And I think these stories are not only interesting and entertaining, but perhaps some of them are educational from the standpoint that's like, okay, I've heard someone who that's happened to, I'm not going to let that happen to me, or I'm going to avoid that pitfall or whatever. So these are stories from road warriors who have actually been there and done that and experienced that, and they were sharing some of those intimate and sometimes embarrassing situations in which they've had something happen to them on the stage or when they're out performing or sometime in their life that's been related to their performance and to their profession. So again, there are several people who are involved with this particular episode, and I want to thank each and every one of them. That includes actually Michael Paul, who is the MC of this show. He's the one who is introducing the thing to begin with. And then also we have on the panel Jaffo, Carl Hein, Charles Peachock, James Brandon, Chris Blackmore, Paul Stone, and Dan Sperry. That's quite a lineup and quite a few stories I know you're going to enjoy. So as I said, Michael Paul is the one who is our master of ceremonies for this session, and I know you'll enjoy it, so let me introduce Michael and let him start the show. Michael, take it away here on The Magic Word.
So we are joined by our panel. Some you have met, some maybe you have not. We are being joined by, of course, Jaffo on the end there. Hi, Jaffo. We are being joined by, yes, he knows who he is. We're being joined by Carl Hein. We're being joined by Carl. Am I right? You're looking at me like what am I doing? I don't know. I didn't even know I was doing this. James Brandon, who you saw earlier. James is here and stayed. Charles Peachock is here, of course. Chris Blackmore is here. And, of course, Paul Stone. Okay. It's like wrangling children or cats. I think the big question everyone's wondering is, who the hell am I? So very briefly, as you heard, we're going to be doing a lot of stories about the road and what it's like to work in the business, the things that are the hardships. My name is Michael Paul. Some people knew me as Michael Ziegfeld when I had a 30-year act as a ventriloquist. I was also an improv comic. I started early enough to tour with celebrities when they still paid for people to tour and opening. Okay, kids. Okay, it's enough. And going to put you in the corner and spank you. And also in Las Vegas, when they had the big Vegas review shows and acts like ours got to have 8-minute spots, feature spots, headlining spots. And so it was a really lovely career. It turned into a little bit of film and television and voiceover work. And in recent years, I've been retired writing and directing for wonderful acts like this. So we all have these kinds of stories. My stories have been everything from someone going up at a corporate event and talking about the Holocaust for a half hour before I had to go on and do comedy. That was terrific. Stories like I had my ventriloquist dummy, the eyeball popped off and rolled away. I didn't know. And I didn't know why everyone was laughing. Fires, people dying in the audience. Someone threw a drink at me and then the whole glass. It's been a wonderful career. But I'm going to tie in a very quick story before we get to the real stories here about my tie-in with magic. Because my very first job around 16 was as a magic technician at a dinner theater in Valley Forge, Pennsylvania. It's just as fun as it sounds. And the magician's assistant, the lovely assistant, took me to the mall, pretended to be my mother, and signed the permission slip for me to get an earring. And that woman was Pam Hayes of the great Thompsonian Company. And the reason she took me under her wing was because I was a horrible spotlight operator. And John was very mad at me, Johnny Thompson, because if anyone, does anyone remember Johnny Thompson? Do you know the bits? Okay. So I didn't know how important these people were as an impact on magic. And I was told that before John is rehearsing and he goes into the dressing room to prepare, don't interrupt him. What they meant was prepare. And so I didn't know that. And if you remember John's piece about with the invisible handkerchief, and then he throws it up and the dove disappears, the invisible, no, yes, the invisible handkerchief. Yeah, the saran wrap bit. Right, exactly. Ventriloquist. And it was a pantomime. And in the pantomime, his last cue was he was in a blue spotlight. He would row the bird up in the air. It would disappear. And the spotlight had to turn to a pink gel. Very simple. New spotlight person, 16. What I didn't know was that theater was training young spotlight guys all week. So, of course, his final cue was messed up every time. And so this very established performer who is supposed to bow to the music. Hey, Dan, come on in. Dan Sperry, if you don't know Dan Sperry, I know. People say we look alike. And but John's supposed to bow in pantomime. The music plays him off. But instead, he was bowing and cursing. And it looked something like this. Thank you very much. Pink gel, you. Thank you very much. Pink, you son of a gun. Thank you. So that was my introduction to meeting people like this. And so, everyone, we're going to start from the end, and we're going to keep these stories a little tight, tell a good story, and then if we have a little time, we're going to throw a little rapid fire at you if we have a little opportunity. So why don't we start on the end and save your questions till the end, because there are no questions to be taken. So this is what we're talking about. Things on the road when they don't work. So it's the on button is usually, thank you. Right on time. Okay. This is what I'm talking about. These sorts of things. Wait. What kind of bar is this? What is happening? Wait, stop. You're upsetting. You're me chewing me, sir. Okay, there you go. Go.
So there was this time at a magic convention. I was handed a bum microphone and the audience thought it was hysterical. Oh, you should have been there. It was like amazing. Okay. Anyway, so I'm Jaffo. For those of you who don't know much about me, my background, I live in Orlando. I worked for a company called Theater Magic. We had magic shops in Universal Studios for 13 years. We have a place in Kissimmee called Great Magic Hall. And we mostly pulled tourists. So it was maybe on a Tuesday or a Thursday, I could do a show for like just two people, a lovely couple sitting in the front row. And I kind of brought the energy down, made it real intimate, give them a whole like 30, 40 minute experience, and they had the best time. So I'm so used to performing for large groups and small groups. Not a big deal. I don't care. So I guess in a couple of years back, season 9 of Penn and Teller, I got invited to go out and perform my billiard ball act. And by the way, this is the story about the most surreal moment of my magic career, the most surreal moment I've ever experienced. And they were still in the dark, dark COVID times. It was just the last year where they had no audience. The following year, they switched out for Brooke Burke. They got rid of Allison. You know, Brooke came out for season 10. They brought the audience back. But the year I was on, they had no audience. And the fun part is, the morning that I was doing the taping, Teller had some other obligation, so he wasn't even in the theater. And so I had my stuff set up, and I did my rehearsal. Everything's fine. All right, Jaffa, we're going to bring Penn in, and then Allison on the stage. You're going to go and do your thing. And I walk on the stage to hit my mark, and there's nobody in the entire... The stage is the size of this room, okay? That's the size of the stage. And then Penn is in the front row, and then Alice is on the stage behind me, and there's literally nobody else in the entire theater. Like, everyone's hidden away in the rafters and backstage. And it's, like, eerily quiet, and I hear, like, the voice, and they played the music, and I just go for it, right? Just boom, go for it. And suddenly, though, I remembered, like, because I know how much this would bother, like, a lot of performers, because they would feel that isolation and it would throw off their timing. I know some magicians who had trouble because they're relying on feedback from the audience, their jokes and laughter. I'm just doing to music. But suddenly, I just felt very relaxed because I've done this 1,000 times, 1,000 with small, intimate audiences. It became, like, no big deal. And it was, like, a cool moment. But that whole idea of just being on the stage with a lovely B-list celebrity, and here's Penn in the front row, it was a great time. So that's my story.
This next story comes to us from Carl Hine.
So many years ago, I used to do a lot of family shows, and I did some library shows. I was on a little tour of doing a library show. It was in Florida. And someone asked me, because I was on this tour, if I could come in and do their elementary school's career day. I don't know if anybody has ever been to a career day where they, you know, people just come in and talk about their careers and this sort of thing. So I had this room that was packed, this classroom that packed with, like, I think 2 or 3 different classes. So it wasn't like a normal classroom. It was just... You couldn't get any more people in this room. And this is the story of the last time I did the finger chopper routine. the very last time. So I'm doing the show, and because it's, one, so tight, and there's so much energy in the show, and two, because there was a teacher that had this laugh that was just infectious and just filled the room. It was maybe one of the most, like, hot. It's just one of the funnest shows I've ever done. So I'm about, like, 15 minutes into this kid show, and it's just through the roof. You could say anything, and everybody would just die laughing and go and scream. And so I go into the finger chopper routine, and I get this kid up on stage. And I have these lines like, you know, raise your hand for brave, raise your hand for so brave for stupid, and, like, just these lines that kind of, like, weed out kids that you don't want up there for a finger chopper type of routine, right? So I get this kid up. He's super excited. He comes up on stage, and then I have some other lines like, you know, your dad's not a lawyer, is he? And you're not going to pee your pants, right? These types of things, right? And the part of the reason you didn't use those in it, did you? Yeah, perfect. Okay, so yeah. but part of the reason why I do that is to weed out kids that aren't going to be great for doing the finger chopper routine, right? And so I get through all this, and I'm just getting to the point where I'm putting the kid's finger in the finger chopper, and I start to realize this kid's not having it. Like, he's starting to get really clammy and shy and so forth, right? So instead of putting his finger, which I've done this before, I put my finger in the finger chopper, and I basically hold his hands, right? So I'm holding his hand like this, right? And I got my finger in the finger chopper, right? So I'm holding his hand. I go 1, 2, 3, and push the cigar chopper type of finger chopper through. And the kid, I would see, like, I think from my perspective, he's just messing with me, and he's like this, right? What I didn't see is that his eyes rolled into the back of his head. So now I'm going like this with a kid that everybody else but me knows. And I realize that he's not joking with me when I start to see the pee come out. Right? So I'm holding on to this kid, and there's pee coming out. And there's literally kids, like, this far away on the ground. And this teacher comes out, grabs the kid, and pulls him out. Like, on the side door. And so I'm like, okay. So the show went from up here to literally submarine. And somehow I brought it up just slightly above floor level. So the ending of the story is I am packing up my stuff, and I'm clearly dressed as a magician, kind of like this jacket here or something similar, and leaving the school with my big, you know, like cart of stuff. And in walks this guy that doesn't look too happy. And it's the dad, and he goes, "So you're the guy." And so the guy says to me, fortunately, he says, "I don't know. You must have had an amazing show, because my kid is the shyest kid in the world, and he would have never come up on stage, never volunteered for a magic show. But he's having so much fun, he lost sense of the fact of his personality, I guess. And now I'm still like in fear that this kid is like the kid from, was it the Adam Sandler movie? It's like, hopefully the kid's okay. I didn't ruin his life." So that's not my worst story. That's that kid's worst story. And hopefully I get the chance to meet him someday and apologize. And that's the last time I ever did a finger chopper routine. So there you
go. I was going to say that kid was my brother.
You beat me right to it.
Now we will hear from James Brandon.
Hey, so I mentioned yesterday during one of the routines that I performed at a place called Alcazar in Paris many, 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 many years ago. So I was 20 years old. This is in 1985, right? The math checks out. I'm 60. This is 1985. I'm 20 years old. I get this amazing job to headline at a beautiful, you know, there's Moulin Rouge, there's Lido, and a couple of other places in Alcazar. It was like that kind of place. And of course, everybody spoke French, but it was for the French. So I'm so excited to perform there, and I'm getting all ready and everything. And I say to one of the other acts, "So is there anything I should know?" And they said, we don't speak English. No, they said, "Yes. Whatever you do, never be late to stage. We just had somebody fired because they introduced the act and it wasn't ready." So in those days, this particular show, Jean-Marie Riviere was a big star in Paris. He was the host of the show. It was his show. And just like in like Cabaret, he would sit in the audience in the bar, in the middle, there was a bar, and he would sit and he would watch the show. There'd be a little light on him. He'd have the microphone and he'd be drinking. And so while the show was going on, the dancers or the acts, he would talk every once in a while. Depending on how drunk he got, he would talk a lot. And he would go like, "Oh, that's fantastic. Look at her," you know, like that kind of stuff. It was really nice. It was very charming and intimate. So I get on stage, and in those days, I was doing my bird act, which nobody here would remember, but long, long time ago. Okay, so we're a couple of weeks into the show. And I know whatever I do, be on time, I'm on time, right? And I'm doing a show where I produce six of those large birds, six of them with no sleeves, no shirt, just the jacket with no shirt. And at the end of the show, I take one of the birds and I set him on fire and I throw him over the audience and he blows up. It's not a real bird. Okay, anyway. But in any case, that was the ending of my show. And we're all magicians here pretty much. I had one of those fake birds hidden in my jacket, of course, for the end of that bit. So I'm in the middle of my act and it's going great. And the audience is great. And Jean-Marie's sitting in front of me like, "Whoa, whoa, whoa." And I'm doing Smoke and Glass. Smoke and Glass is where you catch smoke and you throw it into a glass that's covered with a handkerchief. And I have a new gimmick I got at the magic shop, whatever that magic shop is in Paris, doesn't matter. And you're supposed to... What is it?
Le Magic.
That's it. Yeah. I think it was Le Magique. Yeah, it might have been a different place. Anyway, so I have this new gimmick. I was fighting myself. I'm like, why am I lighting a cigarette with a match when I'm all futuristic in my character? So I changed it to a space age type pipe, and I wanted to light it off my thumb, have fire on my thumb. And so I had this brand new gimmick that's hidden in my hands, and I didn't know how long it would last, so I added extra oil for the first time I did it. And I did that, and I lit the pipe, and I'm all good. I got the glass covered, you know, and it's empty at the moment. And I blow out the thing, and I let go of the gimmick, you know, and it shoots back. And there's a long pause, and then the entire audience lights up like somebody shot a flash camera. And then I go, whoa! So this thing that's meant to shoot up big, a firework, blasts my ass. Pardon the expression. Anyway, so what happened, just a little, one more little thing, is that when I arrived, I had my own beautiful costume that I liked, but it was hand, you know, I made it at home. I was a kid, and they wanted to have Roberto Ruzzolu, this French designer, design me a costume. I worked with him for weeks. He made this beautiful costume, but they lined the inside with this synthetic, whatever, the acetate or something to keep it stiff. So when I blew up, I didn't go out. And so all I'm thinking is don't get fired. Pardon the pun. Yeah. So I'm thinking if I leave the stage, I'm going to be in big trouble. And I just blew up and I'm doing this and trying to get it out. And there's flames coming out of my rear and I'm putting it out and it really hurts, by the way. I was a little bit in shock, but it really hurt. I finally think I got it out. And Jean Marie is just sitting there staring at me. So I got to keep going. So I'm doing smoke in glass. But there's more smoke billowing out of me. The pipe is like inconsequential. I'm doing this. And I'm thinking any second he's got to say, James, get off the stage. You're on fire. So, but every time I look back, it's glowing like your balls. No, you know, it's glowing orange. And I'm like, oh. Shazam! So I'm doing this. Anyway, I pull the cloth off of the thing and there's more smoke outside than inside. And the audience is just looking at me, frightened to death. Okay, so the very, very end. So now, the last part of my show, I change into a clown. So this piece that I did at the end, it used to be part of my bird act where I would change to the devil, then I would change to a clown, I changed back to the devil, which is why I threw the bird and blew up. And so now I'm about to pull on the new costume they made, the clown costume, and I'm on fire, and I'm like, oh, I'm going to destroy this. I mean, I'm really upset. I'm like slowly pulling it up, and finally Jean-Marie goes, James, you're on fire. You can't keep performing. And I'm like, I know. And he's like, and it's like 3 minutes, I'm on fire. They go, please, you must leave the stage. And I'm like, yeah, okay. But I wasn't going to leave with that. So I get backstage. They close the curtains. They put me out with fire extinguishers. I was really on fire. Anyway, I was really burnt. And if that's not a road story, I don't know what it is.
Yep. Burning flesh. Burning flesh is always up.
And I'll tell you, the reconstructive surgery came out beautifully, man. It's very, very good work.
This next story comes from Charles Peachock.
Now, mine really isn't a performance story. It's more of a travel harrowing story. I was working on ships. I worked on ships very young. I started when I was 19 on the main stage. I went almost right from high school into ships. And I was working with my brother at the time. So we were going and stuck between Seward and Skagway. You guys probably know there's nothing there at all. So that's all I saw for like 2 months. And we wanted to get out of town. And it was episode one I just launched, the Star Wars episode one. And we were like, oh my gosh, like, let's find a theater that can do that. Closest theater, White Horse. That was 2.5 hours away. So we got a rental car. And we went. And we saw the movie. It was great. Okay, time to go home. So, and we have to get back, and then we have to catch a ship the next day because we're just overnighting. We're basically doing two ships at one time. We were covering Entertainment Grid for that. So we go to get back, and we get kind of lost. And I don't know if you guys, White Horse, between White Horse and Skagway, basically it's a total void. It is nothing. It's the Yukon. There is nothing there. So we drive back, we get lost, and then all of a sudden I'm like, okay, I'm just going to try and get some sleep. I sleep in the back. And next thing I know, I wake up to my brother going, oh, the car is fishtailing, spinning around, and then smashes into the embankment, blows out both tires. I go out backwards and out the side window. My elbow goes out the window, and then I'm bleeding a little bit, but we're okay. Okay, what do we do? We're in no Yukon. It's getting late, and there's no cell phones back then. This is a whole different time. We're like, All right, well, let's try and get some sleep. I don't know if you guys know, but Alaska is actually a tropical rainforest, so the mosquitoes are quite ravenous. So mosquitoes were already in the car, and so we basically were getting eaten alive. We're like, okay. So you walk that way for 2 hours. If you don't see anything, come back. I'll walk this way for 2 hours. If I don't see anything, come back. And so we did that because there literally is nothing. You can walk and not see a car, another human, another house, anything like that. Yeah, you know.
Bears.
There is that. There is that. They're not going to help us. So we walk. We both walk. I walk for 2 hours. I literally see nothing. I see nothing. I see no person, no car, no anything. Not a single luxury. I come back to the car, and luckily my brother did get a, found somebody, found a phone, found a house. And so AAA came, or whatever it was, came and took the car and then towed us back. And literally we got back just in time to board the ship and do our show. So like no sleep, no anything. And yeah, we made it back. But yeah, that was more of a travel story rather than a performance story.
Hey. And now we hear from Chris Blackmore.
There are so many travel stories. Those of us who have worked cruise ships know that it's just, and the cruise line companies always get the cheapest tickets. So they will send you around the world to get next door. It literally is ridiculous. So mine, I thought of so many stories because I've traveled a lot, like all these gentlemen up here have. But mine literally happened 10 minutes from my home. I booked a gig in December, right? You get gigs, a lot of gigs in December, right? So this happened to be a Wednesday night gig at a restaurant in Westminster, California, about 10 minutes from my house at the time. If you know Westminster, it's a Vietnamese community. And it's just almost strictly Vietnamese in this area. And it was a gentleman who had, he was a representative for one of the pharmaceutical companies. He had a group of Vietnamese doctors that he was taking out to dinner and he wanted to have a magic show for. Great, no problem. Gives me the address again before cell phones and all this. And I go into this little store that's at the address and it's ducks hanging from the ceiling and a little man sweeping the floor, and it's no bigger than this area we're right in. It's really small, and I'm going, I have to do a show here, and there's nobody here. I'm trying to ask the guy where it is, and he finally looks and says, oh, and points down the street. So I'm randomly going down the street, and they had an exact restaurant down the street, the exact same name, the same company, everything just down the street. So I go in there. I meet the gentleman who hired me. He's about 7 foot tall, no lie, 7 foot tall, African American. And there was nobody in the theater, in the restaurant, except Vietnamese and one Marilyn Monroe looking blonde. I'm like, okay, this is interesting. Do your gig, whatever. And he goes, well, they're eating right now. And he was so tall that he had to sit back from the table like this. He's eating like this from the table. And I go, well, when am I going on? He goes, well, after dinner. And I said, okay. And so I wait a half hour and I wait 45 minutes and I wait an hour and they keep bringing trays out with feet sticking up from it. And they had these 2-liter bottles of soda on the thing and they keep bringing trays out. Literally, I'm like, going, have these people never eaten before? It's a free meal, right? Whatever. And I'm going, I just have to go on. I'm done. I want to go on. I told the guy, let's go on. He goes, okay, go on. I go on and I get nothing. I mean, nothing. Nothing. I'm, hey, good evening, rings, Lincoln rings, hey, torn and restored, hey, nothing. Trays of food come by, like, okay, no problem, it's all good, you know, no one speaks English except the gentleman who hired me, and there's a blonde, so I go up to her, I go, I need help, come on, hey, I'd like, don't pick me, well, just come up on stage, no, don't pick me, and it's like, I'm looking around going, what the hell are you even doing here? This is not right. I guess some Vietnamese guy married this beautiful blonde woman there. And I'm getting nothing. The sweat's starting to pour. Everything I'm doing is just going. And I closed with a straitjacket in the day. And so I go, I'm just going into straitjacket. I'm calling it a loss and I'm getting out of here. Right? That's it. It's. I don't have that philosophy now, by the way. It was not a good philosophy, okay, as a performer. But I start doing straitjacket and I bring a guy up and he doesn't speak English and I'm doing stuff with him and trying to get the strap. I go, what's your name? And he goes, hey, I'll be gone. I said, all right, what's your name? I go, I'm sorry. What's your name, please? One more time. Okay. I go, Shamalama Ding Dong. And the place erupted. Shamalama Ding Dong. So, thank you. For the next 20 minutes, I must have said Shamalama Ding Dong 50 times. I walked out of there on a cloud going, what the hell just happened right there? The guy kidding me, he goes, Brian, you were amazing. I'm going, Shamalama Ding Dong. So that's my story. I get tons more, but that was a fun one. Thank you.
Now we will hear from Paul Stone.
So, listen, after I did the Palladium show with Siegfried and Roy, about 2 months after, I'm in Las Vegas, and there used to be a guy called Gary Darwin, who was pretty famous in Vegas, and he used to have his magic club for many years. And they met at a place called Boomer's, which was like a bar, it was a weird place anyway, but and on this particular night, John Calvert, 96-year-old John Calvert, was coming to entertain. He arrived in this huge, great lorry thing that he drove himself. And at 11 o'clock, the show started, and he's got his full illusion show in this small bar area, right? The whole thing is there, right? Okay. So we're there. So watching this, and he's doing everything. He's getting the buzz saw. He's doing the whole thing. And about halfway through at about 12:30, because he's only halfway through, they're having an intermission. And Tammy, who's his wife, who's this gorgeous lady who was his wife, comes over. I knew John, but not well. Said, John would like a word with you. I said, okay. I went over and John said, right. He said, when I'm 100 years old, I want you to produce my show at the London Palladium. And I said, okay, John, I'll tell you what, John, when you're 99, give me a call, friend, okay? 2 or 3 years later, the phone rings. Hello? This is John Calvert. So I said, yes. He said, you're going to produce the Palladium show for me. Now, the thing about Calvert, I don't know if you knew John Calvert, but he was an amazing guy, an amazing magician. But by this stage, he was, he used to do incredible things, fly. The thing about John Calvert, I have to tell you, is he used to fly like 737 planes and huge speedboats. But whatever he had, he crashed them all. He crashed everything. That's what he did, right? And he did blindfold drives and crashed the car. He did all this. Anyway, come to the show. He called. I said, okay, I'll see what I can do. So I decided stupidly, I'm still paying it off now, stupidly, that I would do this show at the London Palladium for John Calvert. And it happened to be, it was going to be when he was 100 years old, and it was the 100th year of the London Palladium. So unfortunately, John in his mind, which is why he lived to 102, he still think he could do his whole illusion show. Of course, at that stage, he couldn't really do anything. But he used to do a routine which was called the Lazy Magician, you may remember it, where he had got a couple of girls up and he would sit, they played his music and they'd sit there and waggle their backsides and he would sit down and tie 3 silks onto a rope and they'd fall off. It was a nice little bit, but anyway. So I said to him, we'll just do that. He got really angry with me. So, I'm talking about a show that cost me an awful lot of money and we had a great bill. We had people like Matt King came over, Hans Klok, a lot of people. We had a really, really good show. We bring John into London like 2 days before because I had my director there because we needed to rehearse him. Well, we spent 2 days rehearsing and he couldn't do this thing with the silks. It was like, it just wasn't wonderful to say the least. But we sort of got there. Came to the show. I'm emceeing the show. We've got a full house at the Palladium and we start the second half and the tabs open and there's John Calvert with his 4 girls either side and then two of them peel off and so he's got a girl in each arm. Now, if you ever saw John Calvert, one of his classic things was he had this strength thing where he'd lift 2 men up and it was an incredible thing he did. And these girls are there and I'm emceeing, so I'm going, John Calvert, this is special, 100 years old, whatever. And as John comes forward, the idea was he was going to do this at the front, right at the front of the stage when Tammy was there, set up. And he starts coming towards me and he's saying, give me the mic. And I know if I give him the mic, he's going to go, this guy won't let me do my whole illusion show. Okay, I've come all this way and he won't do it. What is it? I'm going, so he's going, give me the mic. And I'm going, not on your life. And now I'm doing this whispering so the audience can't hear this, but he can. As he comes towards me, I'm doing this dance moving away from him. We're doing this whole thing where I'm moving away. Finally, the girls get into the front. and sits down. The music goes on. And he does the trip. Not bad. It wasn't a bad trip. I mean, he did okay. He got away with it because he's 100 years old. It didn't matter. So I'd say, ladies and gentlemen, fantastic, John Calvert. John then takes his call, but he takes his call facing upstage. So now he's got his backside facing the audience, and he's bowing the wrong way. So I'm saying, girls, turn it. John, turn around, John. So anyway, we go through that, and it's all over. Show carries on. It was a big variety show. And John was a guest, okay? He was a guest. And I've got to tell you about this. There's a little caveat to this before I finish. Sylvan, if you know who Sylvan is, he's the number one Italian magician, has been for years. Amazing guy. He's been 78 for the last 10 years. He's actually 88 now, but he's still on major TV over there. So we did the posters for the show, and it was all for John Calvert. And I said, Sylvan, will you come over? He said, yeah, I'll come. We printed all the posters up, and he said, I'm not coming. So we were not coming. I want to be the guest of honor. I said, it's for Calvert. I'm not coming. So we had to reprint all the posters and put Sylvan on as guest of honor. So he's in the audience for this show. And there's a lot of people like Jack Codell and a lot of other people, David Burgless, all this, and I'm introducing them. So Sylvan says to me, he said, here's what we're going to do. He said, I'm going to be in the audience in my immaculate tuxedo. He said, you are going to introduce me as Il Maestro, I do the standout. You will invite me onto the stage. I will come onto the stage. We will chat a little bit, and you will say, what a shame that you haven't got anything with you to do the tricks. And then I will click my fingers, and this beautiful girl would come on with a silver tray. You will move out of the way, and I will have a deck of cards, and I will do 4 minutes of my masterful manipulation. Okay, so come the show, we do the whole thing, right? Bring Sylvan on stage, we do this. He gets it, he starts doing his 4 minutes of masterful manipulation where he was flashing everything. Masterfully, mind you, okay? So at the end of the 4 minutes, the music stops. He does another 3 minutes silently, flashing even more. So what happened was, of course, I got him off stage. He's such a cool guy and such a nice man that we couldn't let it. So we then spent the next 2 months editing this tape so he looked sensational, sent it to him, so he thought it was fantastic. So he still thinks he did really well, and he's a cool guy. Anyway, the last bit, just going to the show. So we get to the end, getting towards the end of the show, and I'm emceeing, and I'm on stage just introducing someone, and I can hear pandemonium backstage, and John Calvert's come back up. He wasn't going to be in the finale, the walk down, because he was just a guest, really. He was there, and he's a strong man. Anyway, he's fighting because he wants to be in the walk down. We can't have him because it was late anyway, and we didn't want that. I've got two bouncers, huge guys, who are pinning Calvert to the side of the stage, holding him there, literally fighting with this guy. We do this show, we finish. Anyway, the whole story basically is that John Calvert hated me beforehand because I wouldn't let him do a show. When he was there, he hated me. And when he left afterwards, he hated me even more. So that was the whole story. But history will always show that John Calvert, at 100 years old, played the London Palladium in the 100 years of the Palladium. So that was cool.
All right, Dan, let's hear it.
The final person on the panel is Dan Sperry.
Yeah, I've worked with John Calvert twice. He's intense. And then, you know, he was really nice to me. But
who did he hate more is what I mean.
Probably Paul.
Probably Paul.
Yeah. And I didn't know about it, but I you and Vito were the only two guys I ever saw do smoking glass when I was a kid. That's why it popped in and brought it up. I didn't mean to jump on that. So sorry, folks. And sorry I was late. That wasn't intentional. I'm not doing one of those stupid old like showbiz things where you intentionally show up late so you get your own entrance. You know what I mean? I wasn't doing that. I was really on the phone.
And then, yeah, this whole thing is weird. I got stories, but I don't want to tell them like this. I'll tell them to you all individually or in little groups. Somehow that makes it different, you know,
and easier. So I'm not going to say anything on here. I'll do this one now because I usually say it in my lecture. Because I lecture about a certain SpongeBob things I used to do because I used to do a lot of kids shows, right? And not too unsimilar to Carl's experience, but I did a balls from mouth with SpongeBob because I'd seen Vito do it, and I thought, well, that's neat. but I didn't, I had a whole thing, but the point is I adjusted the sponge balls so they were boogers and I'd pick my own boogers and eat them, right? Shut up. Kids like it. All right. You don't know anything. And so anyways, I mean, you put me on last, what do you think is going to happen? You know, you should have just put me on first and gotten me out of here. So I go to do this kid show and I'm pulling up and I see like a rant, right? And I'm like, well, whatever, you know, like maybe, I don't, whatever, you know, somebody here needs that. But they didn't tell me it was the birthday kid. Usually they would volunteer that information, you'd think. And those of you that do shows, you don't say like, hey, can these people walk or like, you know, you don't bring that up. And so, but I go there, I'm like, maybe grandma and grandpa live at this house. That's cool. You know, like, maybe, I don't know, maybe the Japanese. And so like, I get there and it's a nice house. It's what I lived in Chicago at the time. So it was middle of summer, very humid and stuff. And it's a wooden floor, really nice house. And the kids are in the other room doing like, you know, pizza and ice cream, birthday cake and all that stuff. Cause I always like to be towards the end, right before presents. I kind of, whatever, I'll talk about the election tomorrow. Let's do the stupid story and get out of here. And so I would do the balls around. So the kid, whatever, they say, like, well, we're going to bring Billy in or whatever his name is. And that's when they decided, like, kind of tell me that he, like, he can't walk. He's got braces on his legs. So he can't walk. He can't. So they bring him in, like, Saving Private Ryan stuff, you know. And I'm like, cool. Hey, what's up? And they have a love seat. So I'm like, I can work with it. You know, like, he doesn't have to come up here because he's going to be the star of the show. So I can work with this. So he's going to sit in a love seat closest to me and I'm going to do the show and whatever. And we'll let the rest of the kids in. So the rest of the kids come in after Billy gets seated here. And of course, like the fat friend sits next to him and wedges all up in it. Right. And so the rest of the kids are on the floor and I'm doing the show and I get to the balls for mouth and the kids go berserk because it's like, I'm picking my nose and me, my boogers. And, oh, gross. Man. There's lots of other like gross, like pee pee and poop and stuff in the kid show. So they love that. Shut up. You don't know anything. And so I'm doing it and I get the balls from out. The kids are going nuts. I can see in my peripheral, you know, they're all freaking out. And the fat friend is like doing this and saying like, no, stop, stop, stop. And I think it's because he's barrel laughing, but no, it's because they just ate like pizza and ice cream. And why the parents give them milk with all that stuff? Why do they always do that? You know, if you do kid shows, the parents always give the kids milk with cheese pizza and ice cream and cake. Stupid. And so I'm doing the balls to mouth and the kids are freaking out and the fat kid's getting sick, right? And but as soon as it's clicking, he's like covering his mouth and he just vomits everywhere. But because he's covering his mouth, it goes out the sides, you know? So it's going on the couch and then it hits the wooden floor and it does that. And then it starts hitting the paralyzed kid, you know, and he can't move because he can't walk. So it's getting, is it my time? No, okay. But like, so he's getting puked on, but I'm not touching that. It's disgusting, you know? And I didn't get paid enough for this, like to hell with it. And so the kids are freaking out too and it's starting to smell. Right. Cause it's like one of those old, you know, crappy Chicago houses that don't have central air. So it's like humid and it sucks. And the kids had to leave and they were like, no, we'll like change his shirt and we'll get it cleaned up and we'll be fine. And I was like, no, it's not fine. It's disgusting. And I'm over it. And I left. That's it.
And so. How many more years were you a children's performer after that? How many more years were you a children's performer after that? You still do? Well, that's, yeah. I feel like you would have to pay them for that kid show. Okay. I would like to, maybe one of you could have a lovely assistant who could eat your boogers for you. I'm just thinking it through for the next inception. We'll talk about it. That's gross. I'm sorry. That's gross. Okay. So we have a little more time, right, Charles? Yeah. Okay. I'd like to ask the panel one of two questions. You're welcome to answer either one of those. You know, everyone on the panel has some really great credits, right? People have had touches with celebrity through television and film, or you were acquitted. They dropped the charges. did they? And command performances and things like that. I think that everyone here knows that the key to being a successful performer is probably in our world is making a living at it. And so we're not always a household name. And so I think I'd be curious about two things. A, either what was the singular moment where you thought, okay, I've been killing myself for a couple of years. This is the moment I know that I'm okay. I'm doing well. I am a professional. I wouldn't mind knowing that. I think the panel would, I'd love to hear that. And also something a little lighter, if you don't have anything in that regard, when you've brushed elbows with greatness, big-time celebrities or big-time show business or coming face-to-face with a hero, yeah, fast answers. Who's your big-time hero? Who did you come face-to-face with? Did you bite it or did you really, you know, handle yourself well? Anyone?
Okay, fast answers.
Yeah.
So my last year of high school, I made more than the teacher. So doing kid shows. So I was like, oh, I'm going to be okay. And Brush with Greatness, the movie My Cousin Vinny, I taught Joe Pesci the magic for the movie.
Yes.
And the night I did it, the day I did it, we were at the Mayflower Hotel. I spent the day with him and he got a call and he's talking and he gets off the phone and he goes, okay, I'm not going to try and do an impression of Joe Pesci, but he said, okay, it's going to be me, you, Robert De Niro and his mom. We're going to her apartment. She's going to make us dinner. And I had a show that night and couldn't go, which sucked.
I would say my big problem, you know, we collect credits, right, to get credibility and get bookings. Almost everyone on my resume has done something horrible, and I've had to remove them from my resume. Cosby, Trump, Kevin Spacey. I can't win. I have to start from scratch. Yeah, me too. I was there too. Do you have a story? Yeah.
So my first story is pretty much the same as yours, just in college. Is I realized I could go full-time when I realized I was making more than my professor without even trying, you know. So that was, I guess, the way I realized that. And then celebrity, I did a show once. It was a very small show for Tiger Woods and his son. And it was his ex-wife that hired me and his new girlfriend's there and like their chef. And that's it. So it's like me and the son and Tiger Woods. And it's probably like a 45-minute close-up show. And he's as competitive in magic show as he is on the golf course. And luckily, I'm pretty good at close-up magic. So, you know, it was fine. And so I think the best compliment I ever got was his girlfriend at the time just putting her hand on his knee and goes, you're good at golf. Oh, everything. Yeah, it was like constant. Yeah. But, you know, it's one of those times, too, where there's a couple things where you just take risks. And I got really lucky just by complete chance. And he just had no chance. You know, so it was great.
This is one of those times when I really felt in my head that I had kind of made it to where I was and I felt like I was in the right path. This is in Vegas, 2017, season four. I got invited to show this coin trick on Penn and Teller. I got started with magic with Bobo's Modern Coin Magic. I found it in a Cookeville bookstore, Cookeville, Tennessee, right there in Putnam County, the base of the Cumberland Plateau in Tennessee, was where I grew up. And I had the copy of Bobo. I'd studied for years and learned from it. But eventually I was doing this coin to glass from the book. And then I was told by people, hey, you know, you get to do this offstage rehearsal with Johnny Thompson and Michael Close, and they give you all these nuggets of gold to help you with your routine. So listen, it's worth the price of admission. You should pay them for this privilege. I'm looking forward to this moment. When I do my act in the rehearsal, they can give me this advice, right? I'm waiting for this moment. And I get into that room, and now I'm doing this coin trick, and here's Michael Close, and here's Johnny Thompson, and I'm doing this routine. And then they go off and confer, and they come back. And the whole time, Thompson was just like, oh, like he just watched this, and he was just enjoying every moment of it. And then at the end, all Michael Close said was, I need you to take your hand when you produce the coins and hold it like this for the camera. That was it. That was all the advice they gave me. I'm like, what? That's it? That's so cool. Like, I was expecting them to say, no, you need to do this and change this and move that. But then afterwards, because I'd studied this book, you know, Modern Coin Magic. I still have, like, I have my original copy. In my copy of Bobo, I have the store receipt. And on that store receipt is the date time stamp which marks the exact moment that I began my magic career. That's the receipt that tells me when I started it. So, Thompson knew Bobo, hung out with him, started telling me all these cool stories about his time hanging out with Bobo. And it was really cool, just that moment.
If you're in the performer world, you may have heard of a guy, Anthony Gatto, before. And he is unequivocally like the best juggler that's ever lived, you know. And of course, I always looked up to him. I always watched his videos. Like, it was just, he was unattainable, like God for me. But, you know, 15 years into my career or whatever, I was asked to do a juggling convention. He was the guest of honor, and we got to perform on the same stage. I opened the show, and then he closed the performance. It was about for 1,100 jugglers, and so that was great and in and of itself. But then, like, backstage, we were hanging out, and I was hanging out with him outside of backstage also. Great guy. So he was actually showing me a new trick I hadn't seen before. He's like, "Well, try this." And so we're kind of jamming backstage or whatever. And then I started doing something. He's like, "Well, how do you do that?" And I showed him, and he was figuring it out. And I taught the greatest juggler ever lived a trick, and he actually put it into his show. So that was definitely a moment.
Just like, did you mention Anthony Gatto? So Anthony was great. If you didn't know him, he practiced, like, rehearsed like 4 hours a day. He never stopped. And I booked him first in the Grosvenor House in London. And before he put him on stage, he was literally up in the balcony, just rehearsing for hours and hours and hours. And just before we put him on, he was coming downstairs, down to the main floor, which has like 2,000 people, the big thing. And halfway down the stairs, a waiter comes past and he throws up all over the place. And he just walks around taking care of his own, just practicing. And I just went on. That's the first story. The big story of Anthony Gatto, I got invited to the 30th anniversary of circus performance in Monte Carlo, which is a big thing, the circus thing every year, where they all go for this golden clown, which was this, you know, no juggler ever wanted. But Chris Cremo, who got the silver one, right? And Dick Franco. But anyway, so we were there, and this particular one, Anthony Gatto and Chris Cremo were doing like a double act together, which was pretty amazing. And I was there also with a brilliant act called the Alexis Brothers, who do this amazing hand balancing. Anyway, they had a dinner that year, because it was always hosted, used to be hosted by Prince Rainier, but then Prince Albert and Princess Caroline hosted this dinner for these performers. Everybody was there, the best circus performers, from lion tamers to jugglers to whatever it was. And they had this very special dinner. I got invited. I don't know why, but I did. And I'm on a table with Chris Cremo and Anthony Gatto and his wife or whatever. And they're giving each of them this very special award to mark the 30 years. Sitting at the table, Princess Caroline, very early on in the awards, announces Anthony Gatto, and he goes up and he gets this beautiful award, this last beautiful award, this 30-year thing, brings it back to the table. And I said, "Can I have a look at it?" He said, "Sure." I was in my hands 3 seconds and I dropped it. And the whole thing is smashed in pieces all over the floor. And I'm going, I'm in silence. And then Anthony bursts out laughing. He says, "I just put it in a box." And it was fine. He was great. I would have died, but I never forget that. It was the big...
No. Hey, yeah, come on. I think the first time my wife and I, we used to be an act called Blackmore and Gold, and we did illusions and we traveled all around, cruise ships, all that stuff. And I think our first we thought we made it was when we were on the Statler Brothers show, and they invited us out, and it was kind of a fun story. It was it's the first time ever I had an aircraft not land on approach. Like, they were landing and then they had to power up. Yeah. That was the first time, and it's not enjoyable. It's really not enjoyable at all, because you don't know what's going on, and it's quite. And so there was a snowstorm in Nashville during this time, and we get to the theater. It's at the Grand Ole Opry, right? That's where you perform. It's the backside of it. And, we're doing our thing, and they come up to us right before the show after rehearsal and say that all the roads are closed. You have no audience. You have to go perform your show to no audience. Okay. So we did, and they did an absolutely expert job. Now, my mind as a performer is, where are my beats? Where's my timing? Where I could allow for applause here or laughter. I know they do applaud and laugh. And they brought in an audience the next day for a different taping, and they had the audience go, oh, ah, oh. And I tell you what, it's seamless. You cannot tell the difference. And my brush with celebrity was I was like this with Crystal Gayle, and I got to touch her hair.
What are we doing?
Did you have any brushes with celebrity that you were really inspired by? Or when did you know finally in building your look and style that this was it?
Right. No, but Anthony Gatto is great, though. If you guys haven't looked him up, amazingly talented. I got to see him once because now he kind of quit doing it. He's a landscaper. Oh, okay. So he's doing concrete. Oh, okay. Well, so
he's doing concrete. That's better.
And so, no, but like, you gotta respect him though, because he didn't want to do it anymore. And he just like the best juggler in the world. It was like, I don't want to do it anymore. That's respectable though. Like the Rick Moranis stuff. See, it's not all about all that woo woo nonsense. You know what I mean? Whatever. I didn't do a show with Yoko Ono. All the rumors are true. She's absolutely insufferable. What a bitch. I'm never okay. I don't feel like I've accomplished anything. I'm constantly in a dark cloud.
It's fine. It's been out of the saddle.
There's always somebody coming up.
That's right. Which brings us to my last question real quick. We're going to wrap this up. Wait, it's one more, sir. I'm sorry. Come back. I'm doing as fast as I can, sir. I'm sorry. I'm doing the best I can. Okay. It's true. So before we wrap this up, let me just ask one quick question. You know, to your point about the gentleman who decided, I want to be with my family, I'm going to do some it. When your art pays your bills, it can sometimes taint the well. And there are many times where you create a product, and many times in the beginning we emulate before we come into our own. And then maybe that feels stale. Who am I now? The work is hard. Maybe you do an act that works for a long time. Some people, like straight stand-up comedians, they do an act a year, they get rid of it, they do a new act. Other people believe you are slowly manipulating the artwork for years to make it really fine-tuned. But then you realize maybe it's a little stale. Maybe I'm done. How do you rebirth yourself? Is there anyone here who has wanted to quit and then didn't, and why?
So, I don't need to be on stage. I don't. I need to feel like I have contributed something. I'm an important. I can give to people. It was funny. Like no cues got missed during my set. It was weird. Like everybody else.
There were 18 audio apes up here. It was
So, you know, you have a legacy as a performer, but little did I know I was going to make a legacy for performers. And that gave me an incredible value and a different value and a tangent. And it was just as powerful, I think. And I really enjoyed that. And then I'm making other things. The balls that I was juggling that lit up, those were 2 years in development and a lot of money. They're actually going to hit the market. I partnered with other people there. And I've also have a totally different passive income of a bar product, just not in performance at all. And I'm really passionate about it. If I'm doing something different and it has value, I found out that's really all I need.
You are the Elon Musk of the magician, but you own us all. I don't even think you know my name. I'm like, hi, nice to see you. You say, hello, house number two. But yeah, you're right. The impact is very different, right? Some people go from performance to writing for other acts. But it is a hard transition to know if you can get the same feeling. Certainly.
If you start selling into it, you realize that you have value. That's all that matters, really. Yeah. In my heart, right? Anyway.
So real quick, it's actually two different questions. So I'll just answer both real quick. So the first one is about keeping your act fresh, or, you know, if there's a point at which you decide, maybe it's not. I took my act like 5 years ago after doing it for a million years. And I realized that all the funny stuff in my show I had been accumulating over the years, little by little. That's why I reminded me of that. And I thought to myself, I never sat down and wrote my show. So I decided to sit down and actually write the show and write new stuff, but include the stuff that's been working. And it's amazing how, like, I'm so excited to perform now because it's a totally new show. And there's no little spaces in there anymore. You know, it's all written now.
So that's the first. And then the other thing is, when I left Vegas, so I left to have kids when I was 40. I didn't start having kids when I was 40. And I thought I was giving up show business. And for the most part, I did. I'm not doing any big shows or TV and haven't done conventions in years because I wanted to have kids and be there for them, just like my dad for me. My dad was a famous singer and he stopped touring when we were born to take care of us. And so I diversified. I opened up a home renovation business. I have a team building company. I have an online gift company called Unique Gifts, gift shopping. So, you know, you can change and enjoy, but I still love doing shows. It's just I don't do it for, you know, I do it for corporations.
But we will be selling all those products in the lobby, just so you know.
And sometimes the shows just are so much more enjoyable because it's on your own terms. You know, it's not like I have to do this. I have to lug my stuff. I have to get on all these planes. I have to do these gigs. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Anyone else before we wrap up?
Yeah, real quick. And they talked about the planes and all that. For the traveling, for those of us that did a lot of cruises and all that, it was miserable. It was literally, yeah, the traveling is miserable. It's not enjoyable like people say. Yeah, there are moments that are enjoyable, but it's being on stage. We do that all the point to be on stage. I remember telling my son, who's 30 now, I said, do you know that when you were age 12, I stopped up till age 12, other than our Disney time, where it was, I would go to Disney at 10, I'd be home at 6. It was like a regular job. And I said, do you know that I did everything I could to stay home to make sure I was with you? And he goes, really? Oh, all right. Because from 12 till later, I had a lot of traveling. Not a good choice, I'll be honest with you. It probably should have not been during that time. But the toll it takes on the family at home is immense. And I don't think we always realize that. I was gone 6 months a year with my Warren and Annabelle's gig every 3 weeks at a time. But I didn't turn down gigs that popped up in between. And that was a mistake. I should have turned them down and just relied on my job at Warren and Annabelle's. It paid enough money, you know, but I couldn't turn down those jobs. You know, people are offering because that's part of your, well, I'm becoming successful now.
I think the whole panel and a lot of people feel in any business that it's validation, right? The more you get, the more you grow, the more you get. Yeah, right. It's a little unhealthy.
Yes, but it takes a toll on the family. And I'm glad now that I'm not retired in any way, shape, or form. I still need the money because I didn't say.
And your son is 30 and still living at the house. That's the problem.
No, that's all good with that. But, you know, we've turned into rental income and some other things to generate income. So I don't have to take all the jobs these days.
Okay, before we wrap it, I know Paul wanted to say one thing, anything, or you're good? Just talk to him. I'll give you his room number and the phone number will be in the program.
All I was gonna say, and you probably won't want to hear this, but if you've seen the Illusionist show, you'll know of all the acts that were on, this guy is the most and has been consistently the most popular act for many, many years.
Yeah, that's right.
That was a listener.
Yeah, no, that was
years ago. I'm with Masters of Illusion now.
Yeah, right.
That's why I goes upside down.
Now, I'll tell you something.
Another thing.
But hang on, there's one thing I'm going to tell you. Remember, I was talking about Magic Airs before. When I launched Magic Airs with Siegfried and Roy in 2008, I didn't even know Dan, but I met him in Vegas and he spent hours building the website for Magic Airs. Just did it out of the kindness of his heart. And I'll always remember that. So, I mean, he's got a good heart. Let me tell you.
How about a big thank you to our panel, everybody. Thank you for joining us. Tomorrow is day 3. We will see you bright and early. Get home safely. Good night.
I want to thank my guests for sharing those stories, and especially I want to thank Charles Bach, who is the organizer of Magic at the Beach, for allowing me to record and share these stories with the rest of you listeners. Thank all of you who participated, and thank all of you for listening. I do want to appeal to you again to be sure to use the link for the Amazon affiliate to help with the Magic Word podcast. If you can go the extra mile, it'd be great if you can become one of our friends, the Magic Word, by giving us a donation one time or an ongoing donation, or better yet, with a pledge that you can do each month. And you can do that through PayPal or through Patreon.com. Also, one last thing, I would appreciate if you could give us a 5-star review and also to join our pod letter by subscribing to that and hearing what's happening from week to week and who's coming up each week, and also some suggestions from the archives. We are soon going to be getting into the holiday season. I know many of you are busy doing shows, and I hope that you continue to get your date book filled. So until next week, stay well, get booked, and remember, it's just as easy to keep the top half of your gas tank full as it is the bottom half. Don't run out of gas on this holiday season on your way to a show or the way home. This is Scotty out.